Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Cervical Cancer, HPV, and the Vaccine. Now, you can probably tell right off that I am not Maria Benalek, who is supposed to be hosting this teleclass. In fact, Maria was summoned to an urgent meeting out of her facility, and she's unable to be with us, but I am really pleased to be here. My name is Paul Weber, and it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Tito Lopez. Dr. Lopez is the lead gynecological cancer surgeon at the Royal Cornwall Hospital in the UK. He heads an amazing team of experts who have made their mark truly worldwide. He's recognized as a pioneer in his work, and he is held in very high esteem in the gynecological world. Among other estimable posts, he was the president of the British Gynecological Cancer Society for the best part of 4 years. He's currently a council member of the European Society of Gynecological Oncology. This is getting harder and harder to say. He is one of the authors of the 10th edition of the Gynecological Surgery, which is a primary publication. And he is, in fact, the main editor of the upcoming 11th edition. Dr. Lopez is also the co-author of a book published last year entitled The Prevention of Cervical Cancer, The Role of the Vaccine. Now, I don't think there's a whole lot more that I can add to that right now without rambling too long, so let me just say that I am pleased to introduce Dr. Tito Lopez. Dr. Lopez.
Thank you very much. So I understand the majority of you are not gynecologist for all of you. I'm really bringing this lecture around from my point of view as a clinical gyne-oncologist. The reason I'm giving this talk is that certainly in my professional career, I think the introduction of the vaccine against human papillomavirus may have the biggest impact in my specialty, certainly in my lifetime. Well, that's the hope anyway. As a gynecologist, I really wanted to talk a bit about cervical cancer and explain to you the importance of the vaccine from a global perspective. I think the fact that the HPV vaccine and the role of human papillomavirus in cervical cancer has been recognized as a big issue is highlighted, next slide, by the fact that the 2008 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was shared, and half of it went to Professor Harold Zuhausen for his discovery of human papillomavirus causing cervical cancer. He really came up with that concept in the 70s and really struggled a long time to convince people that HPV was necessary for cervical cancer. I think he was up against scientists and clinicians who believed that herpes was probably more relevant, but he persisted and quite rightly was rewarded of his recognition as part of the Nobel Prize. As I said, I am a clinician, not a scientist, and the science I do discuss here is from what I've read, and please forgive me if what I say may be incorrect. I want to talk about cervical cancer, a bit about screening for cervical cancer, and then the role of human papillomavirus in cervical cancer, and finally the vaccine and the potential future for that vaccine. Now, from the UK perspective, cervical cancer is really quite rare. It's the next slide, sorry. I'm on to the cervical cancer. It's the 13th most common cancer in women in 2005. When I started talking about cervical cancer back in the late 1980s, it was the 8th most common cancer. So it's working its way down. About just under 3,000 women in the UK developed cervical cancer, and deaths in 2006 were less than 1,000 at 950, and both those numbers continue to fall. So why are we talking about a cancer which, compared to breast cancer, where you have about 44,000 cases a year, are we talking about cervical cancer? Well, as you can see from the next slide, if we take a global perspective, we can see that cervical cancer is the second most common cancer in women after breast cancer. It's estimated that there's about 500,000 new cases a year. Now, obviously, that's a guesstimate because cancer registries are not universal, and certainly, as you'll see in the next map, most cervical cancers occur in developing countries where there isn't much data. But there's about a quarter of a million deaths a year. So from a global perspective, cervical cancer is a big issue. And calculations made by the WHO is that with increasing in population, especially in developing countries, there will be a marked increase in the number of cases of cervical cancer in the next 15 years. So the next slide, why, if you look at the map, looking at the incidence of cervical cancer, and this comes from Global Can 2002, and I believe they're due to come out with a new global map in the next few months. But you can see the countries you want to live in from a point of cervical cancer is those in the dark green, such as North America, most of Europe, Australia, and some countries in Asia and the old USSR. If you look at the highest incidence of cervical cancer, that is in developing countries, South and Central America, Sub-Saharan Africa. And as I said, the latest data due to come out from GlobalCan in the next few months shows that that really is becoming more clear that you're getting a lower risk in the northern developed countries and more cancers in the southern hemisphere. Why the difference? If you actually looked at a map like this from the 1950s, you'd find that there would be actually very little difference. And the reason for the big shift and reduction in cervical cancer is because of this man, Georges Papanicolaou, was doing work on cervical or vaginal cytology in the late 1920s and carrying on in the 30s. And what he found is that he could identify abnormal cells which were due to cervical cancer. So he and Herbert Trout in 1945, I think it was, produced a monograph on the diagnosis of uterine cancer by the vaginal smear. It became known as the Pap smear after George Papanicolaou, certainly in the States. And very quickly, it was adopted as screening for cervical cancer. It was introduced into the UK probably late 50s, early 60s. And there was a sort of ad hoc screening program, but that wasn't really rationalized until the late 1980s. So that's a picture of George Papanicolaou and drawing from his book. Why does cervical screening work? It works because there is a potential pre-malignant condition, this is the next slide, called CIN, cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. And we know that probably all cases will go through the CIN stage. And it can take months to years to go from a normal cervix to CIN, and then years to even decades to go from CIN to cervical cancer. We break CIN into three categories, CIN1, CIN2, and CIN3, and the CIN3 being the worst. And even when women have CIN3, probably only between about 20 to 30% of those women will end up developing cervical cancer. You don't go from a normal cervix to cervical cancer without going through that CIN phase, and that CIN phase is what is detected by the cervical smears. So as a screening tool, it's excellent because it's not only reducing mortality, but it's actually reducing the incidence of the disease by picking it up before it becomes cancerous. And not every screening program for cancer does that. The next slide shows the impact that cervical screening has had in the UK. You can see that on the bottom, on the x-axis, you've got years. So cervical screening, the call and recall, where it was computerized, was introduced into the UK in 1988. The dark blue line is related to the axis on the right side, which is the percentage of women screened in the last 5 years. And the pale blue line, with the scale on the left, is showing the number of deaths in England from cervical cancer. And what you can see is before call and recall and the NHS cervical screening program was introduced in 1988, only about 40% of eligible women were attending for their smears. One of the things they did cleverly was to offer GPs a certain bonus if they covered 50% of the eligible population, and a larger bonus if they covered 80% of the population. And what you see is very quickly the percentage of women being screened rose to over 80% within about 3 years. Now, the most important thing in any screening program is that you get good coverage. What you see is, in the pale blue line, is that very quickly after call and recall screening was introduced, that the mortality from cervical cancer dropped quite dramatically. And essentially, since 1988, there's been an almost 50% reduction in mortality and incidence from cervical cancer due to the screening program. So the screening program has been shown to be very effective, not just in the UK, but in the States and other countries that have it. But it's not without its problems. One of them is we've developed an industry. If you look, this is data from 2004, 2005. It's not too different recently. But in England, you have 3.5 million women having smears a year. And of those, about 100,000 new colposcopy referrals occur every year. And total number of colposcopies performed a year in England is about 350,000. So a lot of women being referred for colposcopy. Probably close to 30,000, maybe even 45,000 women having treatment for potential CIN. And most of the treatment now in the UK is by what we call a loop biopsy. And as I said, we're really talking about 2,000 cancers. So you've got this pyramid which starts at 3.5 million, and we've probably prevented about 1,000 cancers. So it's a real industry, cervical screening and colposcopy. In the next slide, again, there are limitations with cervical screening. I think when the government pushed in 1988, they said if women had smears, they wouldn't get cancer. And we know that that's not true. It certainly reduces the risk, but it doesn't prevent it. Any woman in the audience understands the embarrassment of having a smear. It's uncomfortable. It's anxious. They can be anxious waiting for the results. It's a very personal thing. Of the women who go on to being colposcopy, about 8 to 10% will require further investigation and complications related to colposcopy and treatment. It's not a very sensitive test. It can miss cancers and precancer changes and be reported as normal. It's not very accurate at picking up what we call adenocarcinomas. Those are cancers involving the canal of the cervix from the mucus-producing cells. Most of the cancers at the moment are from skin-like cells on the ectocervix. But interesting, as the screening program has reduced the number of squamous cancers, the incidence or the proportion of adenocarcinomas has increased, and in fact there is an actual true increase in adenocarcinomas anyway, and cytology, as we understand, is not good for that. And the whole program is expensive. It probably costs about £150 million or more a year for the cervical screening program. So it's a great screening tool, but it's not perfect. The other thing we have some anxiety in this country is the NHS has always been very proud of the coverage. As I said, the most important thing about screening is that you cover as many women as possible, and we'd always managed to maintain above 80% except for the last 3 years. And the number of women coming for the smears has reduced, and that's a concern because to have a major impact, you need to have a good coverage. And if you consider that about 2,800 cancers that we're getting, half of them are in the 20% of women who aren't attending for their smears. So the more the coverage goes down, the more cancers you're going to miss because women aren't attending for their smears. So that's a major concern. And the biggest concern is if you look at the next slide, and that looks at coverage based on the age of the woman. Now, the highest incidence of CIN, these potential precancer changes, are women between the ages of 25 and 35. So these are the women that you want to attend for their smears and you want to diagnose CIN and treat appropriately. And yet, you can see between 2002 and 2007, the number of women aged 25 to 29 coming for screening has dropped from 75% to 68%. So more than a third of women in that age group are not coming for smears, and that's the highest incidence of precancer changes. So we are worried about that. So we've got a good screening program, which is now appears to be going in a decline as far as attendance. What I'm glad to say is if you look at this map of England, as you can see that most counties still have over 80% coverage, and most of the problems seem to be about around London and certainly the northwest of England. But most counties in England are still achieving 80% coverage. But as I say, each year we're seeing a fall. Okay, so that's about screening, its strengths and its concerns. What about human papillomavirus? What's the issue? And as I said, Zuhausen identified HPV as being important in carcinogenesis for cervical cancer. And although he already believed this in the 70s, it wasn't until 96 that the WHO released a statement in which they said that experts have formally labeled the human papillomavirus type 16 and 18 as carcinogenic to humans. Okay, so they said those two subtypes can cause cancer. And they also identified HPV types 31 and 33 as probably carcinogenic and others as well. And when they've looked for the DNA of human papillomavirus, they found it in 99.7% of cervical cancers. So you may as well say 100% of cervical cancers need infection of human papillomavirus. So what is the human papillomavirus now? I always struggle to pronounce this, but they're a member of the Papaviridae family. It has two strands of DNA, and it has a spherical protein shell, the capsid. And you'll see that that capsid is very important when we talk about vaccines. There are over 100 types of human papillomavirus. Approximately 40 of them can infect the genital tract. In other words, they can cause anything from cervical cancers to warts. And of these 40, about 15 are thought to be high risk for cancer, so they're carcinogenic. Now, two of the genes in the genome of the papillomavirus, E6 and E7, are well-established oncogenes that are necessary for the development of survival. I'm not going to talk about E6 and E7 anymore, but we'll talk about other genes in the HPV which are important to the vaccine. Next slide. Genital high-risk HPV infection and natural history. The few things are important. Infection is caused by skin-to-skin contact, just like young children have warts on their skin related to other HPV types. It's the same for genital HPV. The other important thing is to stress that those of us who are sexually active, we have about a 75% lifetime risk of developing an HPV infection, a genital HPV infection. The point is that the majority of us clear it over the space of about a year to 2 years. Okay? But we're more likely to be exposed to HPV than not. It's commonest in young women, and you can have a look at, there's lots of publications who've shown that it's, when they look at young women going to college, going to universities, as they become sexually active, that there is a rapid increase in exposure to HPV. And you'll find that in women under the age of 25, up to 50% of them can have HPV detected if they look for it. As I said, the majority is a transient infection. We get it, we clear it over the space of about a year to 2 years. But 1 in 20 women, it persists. Okay, and it's that persistent infection that's important for the risk of cervical cancer. And increasingly, people are looking at to see if there's a genetic aspect in women who have persistence of HPV infection as opposed to those that clear it. It's more common in women who are more immunocompromised to have persistence of the infection. So women who are HIV positive or who are on immunosuppressants for transplants, these women are at more risk of developing persistent HPV and precancer and cancer. The next slide shows HPV types and cervical cancer throughout the world. And any talk in HPV, you'll always see this slide shown. And what it shows is that HPV 16 is the commonest HPV infection found in cervical cancer. Now, this graph is looking at cancers where they only found one HPV type. in a lot of cancers, they'll find multiple HPV types, but they just looked at those that had one HPV type, and you'll see that 16 worldwide is responsible for, or found in about 54% of cervical cancers. HPV 18 is the next most common, about 17%. So you put the two together, it's about 71% of cervical cancers have HPV 16 or 18. After that, you've got 45, 31, and 33. And then for each HPV type after that, you can see it's in single percentages. And again, this is important when we look at the development of the vaccines. Both vaccines currently cover the two most common, that's 16 and 18. The next slide, although I've labeled it as HPV types in cervical cancer, that's wrong, it should be CIN. So we've looked at the slide on cervical cancer, these are in CIN lesions, but what this does is it's looked at the different HPV types affecting different continents. And again, the important thing to see is that 16 and 18 are consistently the two most common HPV types related to cervical cancer. But after that, there is variation. So you'll see in Africa, the third HPV type is 33, followed by 45. In Africa, it's 58, followed by 33. North America, 31, followed by 33. So there is some variation after the two most common. But the two most common types are 16 and 18. And interestingly, in a meeting I was recently in Sweden, they had some more data, which is due to be published, looking at HPV types in about 10,000 cancers worldwide. And what they found is in the adenocarcinomas, the one that is detected poorly by screening and the one that's on the increase, 18 accounts for almost 40% of them. So 16 and 18 put together account for almost 80 to 90% of glandular adenocarcinomas. And again, that's important when we look at the vaccines that have been developed and coverage. The next slide, again, is just to remind you that HPV does not just cause cervical cancer. It's responsible for the majority of vaginal cancers, three-quarters of vulval cancers, and penile cancers, which show basaloid changes. So there's two histological types for vulval cancer and penile, but certainly in the younger woman of vulval cancer, the majority are related to HPV, so three-quarters of those types. The other keratinizing type of penile or vulval cancer is probably only about 10%. Anal cancers are related to HPV, most commonly 16 and 18, and that's an increasing problem in men who have sex with men, homosexuals. And then you can see that the interesting thing is that about a quarter of head and neck cancers have been shown to be related to human papillomavirus. So it's not just cervical cancer that could benefit from a vaccine, it's all these other cancers. The unfortunate thing for women is that 90% of cancers induced by human papillomavirus, 16-18, are in women. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, again, not related to HPV 16 and 18, but there's an increasing belief that skin cancer is not related to melanoma are probably related to human papillomavirus, other subtypes. So increasing evidence of human papillomavirus being involved in cancers. If we go on to the vaccine now, this slide, this diagram, this is the most important thing that made vaccines possible. And there's three different laboratories in Australia. Ian Fraser is famous. I think he was made Australian of the Year, Australian Male of the Year in 2006 for this discovery. And what they found is if you could produce the L1 protein, then those proteins would self-assemble into the capsule that covers the that surrounds the DNA in the virus. So all they had to do is produce the L1 protein, and you got spontaneous formation of the capsid, the virus-like particle. Now, this is not identical to the human papillomavirus capsid or capsule because that also has L2 proteins, but they found that the L1 protein is the major protein required to make a capsule, and you didn't need L2. So this discovery that you produce a protein and it would self-assemble into a capsule, which looks very much like the virus itself, was the major breakthrough. If we go to the next slide, and this, I'm really trying to show you from a vaccine point of view or from the immune response of a body. If you look at the left, you've got the, what is the human papillomavirus with its capsule. On the right, you've got the virus-like particle. It looks very similar. In fact, these two diagrams are identical. It's just to give you an idea that they look very similar. The next slide shows the difference. The difference is that the virus-like particle does not have the DNA of the human papillomavirus inside. So when people are talking about vaccines and the risk of developing an infection, there is no risk of developing the viral infection due to injections with HPV vaccines, because all it is the protein capsule with no DNA at all. So the self-assembly to form the capsule was the most important step. And then the next thing was to see if producing vaccines with these virus-like particles were effective. So the first work was done in animal studies, and there are viruses, human papillomaviruses, that can affect animals. And examples of these are the cotton-tail rabbit papillomavirus and the canine oral papillomavirus. And this diagram is showing you that these, they produced a virus-like particle for the cotton-tail rabbit papillomavirus. They vaccinated some of the rabbits. They gave placebo vaccines to the others. And then they infected them with the wart virus. And what you can see is on the left is the warts that developed in the rabbits that were not given the virus-like particles. And on the right, they were. And you can see there's a really prevented the warts forming. So this is proof of principle in animals that the virus-like particle vaccines did work. And then what they did is they looked at the immune response in humans. And the next slide shows they actually looked at HPV-11, which doesn't cause cervical cancer. It's one of the ones that causes genital warts. And they looked at the neutralizing response to HPV-11 virus-like particles. So we see that in animals it prevented warts, and we see in humans and women that there is an immune response when you introduce virus-like particle vaccines. So there's the evidence to suggest that these things would work. So two companies developed vaccines against human papillomavirus, and these are the two vaccines that are currently licensed. The first one is by Sanofi Pasteur MSD, known as Gardasil, and that received FDA approval in June 2006. The second vaccine is GSK's vaccine, Cervarix, which approved European approval in September 2007, and it's still awaiting FDA approval. Now, there are some fairly major differences between the two vaccines. The first one, Gardasil, is actually what they call a quadrivalent vaccine. So they included 16 and 18, which are responsible for 70% of cervical cancers, but they also included HPV 6 and 11. Now, these are not carcinogenic, but they account for 90% of genital warts. So I think they're quite clever and introduce this vaccine that not only should prevent cervical cancer, but will also prevent genital warts, which are a major public health problem. I think in the UK or in England, there's 80,000 new cases of genital warts referred to GU clinics. Cervarix, GSK, decided to just stick to an anti-cancer vaccine, and they had HPV 16 and 18, but nothing against genital warts. The other big difference between the two is the adjuvant. And an adjuvant, you probably know more about this than I do, but the adjuvant is something that's included in the vaccine to stimulate the immune response. And MSD used a fairly standard adjuvant, but GSK introduced this novel adjuvant, AS04, which has been shown to produce more of an immune response. They both involve three injections, and this is a big issue when we look at developing countries. So those are the two that are licensed currently. And Gardasil, obviously, is what is used in the States where it's licensed. Cervarix is not licensed there yet. And in Europe and Australia, mostly Gardasil, but in the UK, we've moved to Cervarix, and we'll talk a bit more about that later on. Okay, so the important things of any vaccination program is to look at the immune response. If you don't get a decent immune response, it's not going to be a good vaccine. We want to look at the efficacy, and does it reduce cervical cancer. The problem we have, as I showed in one of the earlier slides, it can take anything from 10 to 20 years to develop a cervical cancer. If you think that, and we'll see later on, most of the vaccines are given in girls aged 12 to 13. Screening programs tend to start in the UK, in England, it certainly starts at the age of 25. So it's going to be a long time we see any evidence of reduction of cervical cancer, maybe as much as 20 years. But there are other things that we can look at. We can look at whether we prevent HPV infections with a vaccine. More importantly, can we stop persistent infection, which is the one that's at risk of developing cervical cancer? In other words, can we prevent the HPV infection lasting more than 6 or 12 months? Do we prevent cervical smear abnormalities? And do we prevent CIN, this potential precancer change? And both the World Health Organization and the FDA have accepted CIN 2 or CIN 3, the more severe abnormality grades of CIN, as endpoints for the trials, because as I said, we couldn't wait for cancers to be developed or prevented. And the other thing, obviously, is safety, and I'm sure you've heard some of the issues regarding safety of the vaccine. Now, this is being fair to both companies, is to show the immune response for both. This first slide shows the immunogenicity Gardasil, and the white line that we see at the bottom is really the immune response that they've detected in women who have been naturally exposed to HPV. Some of them have evidence of a slight immune response. The green line shows the immune response brought about by Gardasil. Okay, and what you can see is a much more dramatic, if you think it's a log scale, the y-axis is a log scale, a dramatic response in immunogenicity. The problem we have is that both companies have used different ways of assessing the immune response. So until recently, it's not been comparable, but a dramatic response there with Gardasil. And again, this is a study published in The Lancet by Diane Harper looking at the immune response with, I think this is HPV 16. And you can see, again, natural immune response is the brownish columns, and the vaccine is the immune response induced by the vaccine. So again, we're talking about a log scale, and it's quite dramatic. Now, as I say, GSK have harped on about their adjuvant producing more immune response. And in Sweden, they decided to do a head-to-head comparison assessing immune response in the same way. And they certainly have shown at 6 months to have a stronger immune response with Cervarix than with Gardasil. Now, whether that has any impact clinically, again, we won't find out for a long time. But when they've compared the two, there seems to be more of an immune response with Cervarix. If we go on to the next slide, we now want to see the efficacy. And now I'm assuming I've sent two slides. I think the first slide is one of the immune response for Cervarix. And again, remember that we're looking at the impact on 16 and 18 related events, not the other HPV types. And we have endpoints, ascus and LCIL are American terminologies for abnormal smears. And then we've looked at CIN1 and higher and CIN2 and higher. And what you can see, this is a small study, but you look at the number of women vaccines about having the vaccine, about 500, and similar number in the placebo. And you can see, let's look at the bottom line first, CIN2, that's the surrogate endpoint for cancer. And you can see that there were no cases in the Cervarix vaccine group compared to 5 in the placebo arm. So the numbers are small, but there certainly seems to be, looking at SIN2 plus, SIN1 plus, and the abnormal smears, a significant difference between the two groups. And if we look at the next slide, this is looking at Gardasil, slightly larger numbers here. And again, we're looking at 16 and 18 related events. There are other cases of CIN3 in other HPV types, but this is just the ones the vaccine are aimed at. And you can see CIN3 and AIS. AIS is adenocarcinoma in situ, so it's the glandular equivalent of CIN3. Again, you can see no cases in the vaccine arm compared to the placebo arm. And at the bottom there, we have this is external genital lesion. So we're talking about warts. So Gardasil is showing that it prevents a genital wart. So both vaccines and the trials that have been published look incredibly effective, as close to 100% as you can get. And so it's effective. What about adverse events? Now, I just combined GSK's data and MSD's data for Cervarix and Gardasil. And looking at the vaccine versus the placebo, if you look at the SAEs, serious adverse events, for both companies, they seem to be small. And the interesting thing is those in the placebo were as common as they were in the vaccine. So there doesn't seem to be anything in the vaccine related to the virus-like particles that is a concern as far as serious adverse events. So the next slide really summarizes what Margaret Stanley said with regards to the L1 VLP vaccines that both companies have produced. And essentially efficacy greater than 90% for persistent infections, which is important because we know persistent infections are what leads to cancer. 100% protection efficacy for disease 5 years post-vaccination. So as far as CIN2, there's essentially 100% protection. That's for 16 and 18. We're not preventing all CIN2s, just those related 16 and 18. Dramatic immunogenicity responses, antibody concentrations to both vaccines, and both of them have shown over 5.5 years to be sustained above natural HPV infection immunity. The vaccine antibody levels maintained over 5 years, and what we're going to find is every few years that it continues, and people are now saying that you're probably going to be able to avoid boosters for probably anything up to 20 years. And as far as in the published data in trial, which involved 70,000 women, there were no vaccine-related serious adverse events. Okay, so both vaccines have been licensed. Gardasil has been out much longer in the States and in other countries. And again, in the next slide, what you'll see is that post-license, there have been concerns raised about thromboembolic episodes related to Gardasil, Guillain-Barré syndrome, and death. Now, you see that MSD, they estimate that 30 million doses have been distributed, and certainly in the USA, at least 8 million women have received at least one dose. So a huge number of people have been vaccinated. They have found in feedback, the thromboembolic episode seems to be in women who already had risk factors to thrombosis on oral contraceptive pill. So it doesn't seem, it seems to be women who are prone to thromboembolic episodes. The Guillain-Barré syndrome, they, up to February 2009, they had identified 36 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, giving an incidence, I think, of about 7 per 100,000, I think it is, or 7 per million. So it's rare. Natural incidence is thought to be about 4 per million, so a slight increase, but they don't think it's anything statistical. But they have raised concern because three-quarters of the Guillain-Barré syndromes occurred after within 6 weeks of the vaccine. So it's something that they're keeping a close eye on. And I'll come on to the Cervarix data when I talk about the UK cervical screening program. So as I say, Cervarix was licensed after Gardasil. Now, in the UK, it was decided that there was enough differences between the two vaccines that if they were to introduce a national vaccination program, they would not allow both of them to be available. So it went out, they first of all agreed that it would be offered, and then they asked both companies to put in cases, and they chose Cervarix. Now, my initial response was, you know, why Cervarix? Both of them have been shown to be effective against CIN2, probably should be as effective for cancer, but one had benefit of preventing genital warts. My understanding is when they've looked at cost effectiveness, the treatment of genital warts was not enough to justify going for the increased cost of Gardasil. So Cervarix has been chosen as the vaccine for the national vaccination program in this country. From a cancer point of view, I don't think the two of them will show much difference. So the next slide really shows, you can get this on the web, it's the Department of Health training slides sets that they have available to teach people about the vaccination program. The next slide shows the outline of the HPV vaccination program in the UK. And what you can see is they've chosen to give the vaccine in girls aged 12 to 13, so in their first year in secondary school. The interesting thing about the immune response to the vaccines is that the younger you are, the greater the immune response. And certainly in bridging studies that they did in young girls and boys from the age of 9, 10, even younger, they had a higher immune response compared to 11 and 12-year-olds, 12, 13-year-olds, and 18-year-olds. But I think the decision was made that it would be more appropriate in girls starting secondary school, where it may be more relevant than those in primary school. So as of this academic year, September 2008, the vaccine has been offered to girls aged 12 to 13. In some counties, this is done through the school vaccination program. In others, it's done through the general practitioners. I'll give the UK its due that they also agreed to offer a catch-up. Now, these vaccines are very expensive, but they decided for 2 years they would offer a catch-up program for girls essentially aged 14 to 18. So in 2009, 2010, it was for 16 to 18-year-olds, and in 2010, 2011, for 15 to 7-year-olds. And again, we'll look at the slide later on, which shows what the take-up has been, because that's important. Just like in the screening program, you want good coverage if you're going to prevent a disease because through herd immunity. And the next slide, which shows the uptake of Cervarix. And if you think this has only been going since September 2008 to early 2009, so probably about 6 months, if you look at the England data, 84% of girls aged 12 to 13 have received the first dose, and just under 80% the second dose. Now, those doses, if I recall, are about a month apart, and the third one is usually 6 months after. The 17 to 18-year-olds, which has tended to be in England offered to GPs, the uptake has been a little less, but it's still fairly impressive, just under 80%. But the second dose is still a bit low, but that should increase. Now, in Scotland, where both are offered through the school vaccination program, you can see it's very impressive. In 6 months, they've had over 90% take-up in uptake in girls 12 to 13, and almost the same, nearly 90% in the 17 to 18-year-olds. So in a very short period, it's been an impressive uptake of the vaccine. You know, there's the usual concern, and you see this more in the States, about whether if you offer a vaccine, you're going to introduce increased promiscuity and that sort of nonsense. But I'm glad to say the uptake has been incredible in this country. Now, what about the monitoring? The Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, it's a government agency which is responsible for ensuring that medicines are acceptably safe, so they've been collecting the data, which is essentially the yellow forms which are submitted. And you can see that there's nearly a million doses have been given in the UK. And you can see, just like with the trial data, most of the problems were with injection site pain and swelling. They had 573 cases, some allergic reactions, which could be local or more widespread. They have these subcategories, so psychogenic, the majority of that was feeling faint or dizziness, just under 1,000. The others category, nausea, headache, dizziness, which is just over 1,000. And they have this category not currently recognized, but there was one case of Guillain-Barré syndrome. Excuse me. So the incidence of Guillain-Barré syndrome in this, if we accept 800,000, nearly a million doses, seems to be certainly not increased compared to the natural population. So post-license, it certainly seems to be a very safe vaccine. And we can see that from the previous slide, the uptake in the second vaccine was still very high. Okay, what about the future? Developed countries, certainly the U.S. and different states are offering the vaccine. I mean, that, in some of them, there's a big issue about trying to make it compulsory, but that's not the case. Most European countries are offering a national vaccination program. I know Austria are offering it to girls and boys. That's another issue. People keep saying, should we be vaccinating the boys? As I say, it's a very expensive vaccine. I think the feeling is if there's a good uptake, certainly over 75% in girls, there will probably not be a need to vaccinate the boys and you'll get a herd effect. In Australia, it's been offered for a while now. But what about developing countries where it's most important? What about the other HPV types, and should we be creating vaccines that cover more of those? And what about different administrative routes? So I just want to talk a bit about cross-protection. We'll cover it here, underdeveloped, but it's a good time now. As I said, both vaccines have provided protection against 16 and 18. Now, both of them have shown there is a degree of cross-protection against other HPV types. If you look at the phylogenetic tree of human papillomavirus, you'll find that there's quite a bit of similarity between HPV, say, 16, I think it's 31 or 45, and 18. And certainly GSK have just shown on some recent data that the vaccine for 16 and 18 appears to offer 100% protection against CIN caused by HPV 45 and 31. So it's preliminary data, but if we accept that, it looks as if the vaccine will not protect or prevent 74% of cervical cancers, but may actually prevent about 84%. And Gardasil, again, has shown similar cross-protection, not 100%, and it varies on the different HPV types, but there does seem to be some cross-protection. So it's looking even more optimistic that the vaccine will prevent more cancers than we anticipated. The other important thing, based on the data coming out from the IARC, hopefully in the near future, is the adenocarcinomas, the ones that are detected poorly by cervical screening. It appears that HPV 18 has a higher, is more common with adenocarcinomas, and just by having a vaccine for 16 and 18, it looks as if we're probably going to prevent over 80% of the adenocarcinomas. So even just in the vaccines we have, it looks as if we're going to get more protection than just for the 16 and 18 subtypes. The other thing is, what about producing vaccines for other types? And I know that MSD are certainly working on a vaccine, I think, which is going to cover 8 or 9 HPV types. Now, 2 of those will be 6 and 11 for the genital warts, but again, they're looking at covering at least the 5 most common HPV types related to cervical cancer. So it's looking as if we're going to be approaching protection of maybe up to 90% of cervical cancers, which again is excellent news. The trouble with the vaccines at the moment is they're incredibly expensive. I don't know what the deal was that the government approached, but if you were to buy the vaccine, you're talking about almost £300. It may have dropped in price, but £300 per injection. So you're for the 3 vaccines, sorry, just over £100. So you're probably talking about close to £300 for the full vaccination. So it is expensive, and those are not the sort of prices that could be paid in developing countries. The other thing is that they need cold storage, and again, that's difficult to do in developing countries. And the third thing is that the only vaccination programs that have been shown to work in developing countries is those given in infancy. Now, to try and give three injections 6 months apart is going to be very unlikely to be successful. The next slide, in developing countries, what about the future? This is something I got off the web, talking about using tobacco plants in vaccination programs. And what they've done is they've instilled the L1 gene into the plant DNA so that the tobacco will express the L1 gene. And what it says here is that they might be able to mash it up and produce a vaccine or virus-like particles or certainly the L1 protein for as cheap as $3. So we have to wait and see what happens there. As I said in the next slide, increasing HPV subtypes, they are looking, certainly MSD, at looking and producing vaccines with at least 8 to 9 HPV types. I'm not too sure what GSK are doing, but I'd have thought they're probably looking at moving in that direction. The problem is the more virus-like particles you introduce, the poorer the response is meant to be immunogenetically. And then different administration routes, they are really looking at whether they can use nasal sprays so that, and they've certainly done some work where you can use a nasal spray and induce a predominantly IgA response. And they've also looked at whether you can eat it, but you need very high doses of the protein to be able to produce a response through oral uptake, and others have talked about whether you could put local applications onto the cervix. So they are looking at seeing what they can offer to introduce it to developing countries where it is the most important. So we just have to wait and see what happens. And hopefully, as a result of the vaccination program, we will see a prevention of cervical cancer. I will probably have retired by the time there is any evidence, but interestingly, with the catch-up program in this country, certainly in Scotland, where smears start, they start taking cervical smears at the age of 20, and with the catch-up program for 18-year-olds, maybe in as soon as 2 or 3 years, we might see a reduction in girls of abnormal smears. If we look at the last two slides, the graphs, this one is really showing the impact of HPV 16, 18 related cervical cancer incidence. If you offering a vaccine at 12-year-olds, and you can see there's three lines. There's the top line, which just continues incidence per 100,000 if no vaccination program is introduced. The red line is looking at the drop in the incidence of cervical cancer if you just vaccinate 12-year-old girls. So you can see that you're only going to start seeing a drop after 10 years and maybe a 50% reduction by 30-something years. And if you offer a catch-up up to 26-year-olds, which does not happen in this country, you should see that drop much earlier. And then the next slide is really looking at, will we see an earlier impact in relation to the potential precancer changes of CIN2 and CIN3? You'll see that, again, similar things. If it's just introduced to 12-year-olds, you may start seeing a fall at 10 years and halving by 20 years. But if you give a catch-up program, you could see a halving of CIN3 by about 10 years. And I think certainly data from the States, looking at the women who were in the trials, the initial trials, they're already starting to see a reduction in the abnormal smears in these women, but they were in older women. So that really sums it up. The last slide just really is me saying I think Zuhausen deserved the Nobel Prize for the work he did, which is really in a very short space of time, showing that HPV is important to producing a vaccine which will hopefully prevent cervical cancer. And we just have to see what happens over the next few years. Thank you very much.
Dr. Lopez, thank you very much. And it's a lot of stuff. I'm glad that you saved your slides until you went to that conference in Sweden, because I suspect that you added something to it afterward. So thank you for all of that. Thank you to all of you for joining us. Until we speak again, everyone, goodbye.